Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland. Many people are so nervous about the future of the economy, they're wondering where to put their nest eggs.
The really important thing is to continue investing in those accounts because you're looking at a long-term outlook here.
That's Janet Bodner of Kiplinger's Personal Finance Magazine with this week's Marketplace Money Inside quote. What investment does she suggest people hold on to? Is it A, violin futures? A recent study found that many high-end violins have averaged a return of between 3 and 4%. Or is it more like B, the stock market? Even though we're in a volatile period, it's the best way to fight inflation. Or is the answer C, chicken coops? With eggs getting more expensive, access to these daily deposits is anything but foul. Stay tuned. The answer is on this week's Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. It happens every quarter, earnings season. Corporations tell their shareholders how they're doing. But honestly, it's always a bit of a mystery why investors react the way they do. What's up is down, what's down is up. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrive and Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
So last month, J.P. Morgan announced a 50% plunge in first quarter profits. And the stock price jumped. Huh? And it seems like every time Apple announces a nice bump in earnings, the market groans over another E word, expectations. Companies fall below what analysts said they would. What is it with these expectations? What are they? Who decides them? Should it matter to investors? As the first quarter earnings season winds down, we asked Marketplace's Elisa Roth to find out.
The earnings results for a company whose products range from light bulbs to TV programs matched Wall Street expectations.
More than double the 1.3 million barrel decline analysts expected.
Google, too, handily beat the street's expectations with their earnings results.
The bigger story Tuesday was earnings. Coca-Cola and Johnson & Johnson, which topped Wall Street expectations.
Target, one of my favorites, beating analysts' first quarter expectations.
So do analysts just make these predictions up?
Different analysts do things differently.
That's Rick Mendenhall, a finance professor at University of Notre Dame.
Mostly, they are doing what we call pro forma financial statements. And so they are starting with a sales or revenue prediction, and they're just building an income statement from there, and they come up with a forecast for earnings.
A quick translation. He says analysts are guessing what the company's going to say about how much it earned. He says the market uses those predictions to gauge how much a stock is worth.
If on average we expect to see a dollar of earnings, and say we see 80 cents, then, yeah, the price of that stock is going to go down.
Even if a year ago the stock was only worth 50 cents, if we or the analysts think the stock should be worth more, we're disappointed when it's not. Companies try to get around this by managing analysts' expectations. It's a little like when your kid brings home a C in chemistry. If he's already warned you he might fail, you'll be pleasantly surprised by the C. Expect an A, though, and this C is a big disappointment. Analysts don't always get it right, but when it comes to predicting future earnings for a company, Mendenhall says investors are better off listening to an analyst than, say, looking at a stock's past performance.
Unless you're willing to scrutinize the company, look at their product line, look at their competitors, estimate what sales revenue will be, then estimate all the costs in the income statement down to earnings, unless you're willing to do that, I think analysts are the only game in town.
But he says most individual investors should just keep their heads down and concentrate on developing balanced, diversified portfolios. These days, a lot of individual investors rely on vehicles such as mutual funds. In that case, Mendenhall has another suggestion.
I think most of us would do well to ignore the analysts.
Better to keep an eye on the fund manager to see how she's performing. Companies like Morningstar rate fund managers so you can see if yours has been doing a good job. But if you decide to listen to the analysts, and if you're investing in individual stocks, you'd better. It's worth making sure there's no conflict of interest. Beverly Walther's an accounting professor at the Kellogg School of Management. She says there are several things investors should ask.
Do they do investment banking business or not? Moreover, do they do investment banking business for the firm that the analyst is issuing a forecast on?
Walther also suggests reading analyst disclosures. Do they have the company's stock in their own portfolio? And check analyst ratings in sources like the Wall Street Journal to see how accurate they've been in the past. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 company helping members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement. And by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation. Online at kauffman.org.
Just how bad is inflation these days? Well, consider this. It costs 1.26 cents to make a penny and almost 8 cents to make a nickel. This week, the House passed a measure that would require the Mint to make both out of cheaper steel instead of zinc, nickel, and copper, all of which have seen run-ups in prices on the commodities markets. Inflation is showing up in other places as well. Oil hit all-time highs this week. Food prices are setting records, too. If you're trying to figure out where to put your money to protect it from all this inflation, good luck. Janet Bodner is with us from Kiplinger's Magazine. Welcome back to the show.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Tess.
So let's deal, first of all, with a Federal Reserve that has slashed short-term interest rates over and over and over again. And, of course, that means savings accounts and CDs are paying, what, 2, 3% at most if you're lucky. And that's really not going to help you overcome today's inflation figures, is it?
Well, those rates in particular won't, but there are still places online, in particular, online banking institutions that will pay higher rates than that, that are at least level with the inflation rate, sometimes maybe even a little bit higher. The second thing to remember is that interest rates are low because the Federal Reserve has been cutting interest rates. But if you really do believe that inflation is going to be rising over the next year or two, then those rates are going to come up as well. So as long as you have your money in short-term savings accounts and you're not tying your money up for 5 years or for the long term, you would benefit from rising rates as those rates naturally go up with the market. And also, again, as banks themselves may be looking for new money, and so they'll be raising their rates to draw money in.
So it sounds like the key there is not to get yourself into like a 5 or 10 year CD.
Exactly. You don't really want to do that. So it just goes to show it's kind of a volatile time right now. People don't quite know what's going to be happening.
I wanted to ask you about Treasury inflation-protected securities. These are what are known as TIPS, and these are bonds that guarantee that they will keep up with inflation. But there's a problem with that right now, isn't there?
Yeah, there is a problem with that because they're so darn popular that the rates are actually quite low, and they're not necessarily keeping you up with inflation. There is an inflation factor built into the pricing of those, and so theoretically, at least, when inflation goes up, you're supposed to get an inflation premium. So again, you're kind of betting on how much inflation is going to rise and whether the inflation premium that you're going to get is going to make up the difference.
Two of the classic inflation hedges, real estate and precious metals, gold. Of course, we've been hearing a lot about gold over the last few months, but those aren't really viable options right now, are they? Because obviously the real estate market, homes are in decline in terms of their value, and gold is so high at this point that if you get into it, isn't there a risk that you're not going to go any higher?
Right. You're going to be buying at the top. Yeah. I mean, there are lots of potential investment bubbles out there that are kind of based or predicated on the notion that there's going to be increased inflation. So what happens if that doesn't happen? Then a lot of these commodities are really overpriced. One thing that we at Kiplinger's have done, we have a listing of funds, our 25 favorite mutual funds. And what we did this year, for the first time ever, we actually included a very well-diversified commodities fund. And so what happens is you're not betting on some commodity that you really don't know anything about. And a lot of regular investors just aren't familiar with commodities. And I think that's kind of the way to go if you are worried about inflation and you want to have some of this protection in your portfolio.
Okay, well, that's certainly one way to go. But where else can you park your money right now? Assuming that you're not comfortable with taking some losses in the stock market, where will you get some sort of inflation protection?
I got to say, the stock market is it, Tess. I mean, when you look over the long term, and this is what we're talking about here, the historic yield on the stock market is a roughly 10% a year, give or take, you know, depending on what period you're looking at. And it is the one single thing that keeps you ahead of inflation. If you're talking about long-term investors who have money in their 401ks, money in their retirement accounts, the really important thing is to continue investing in those accounts because you're looking at a long-term outlook here.
All right. Janet Bodner is deputy editor of Kiplinger's Personal Finance Magazine. Thanks for your help today.
Oh, my pleasure, Tess.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Our economics editor, Chris Farrell, is here for the audio op-ed we call The Straight Story. And Chris, I want to talk about the markets because it has been the most incredible roller coaster. But now this roller coaster seems to be going back up the track.
Well, let me go out on a limb here. Part of it is that I think the credit crunch is behind us. It's not even the credit crunch. It's the fear of financial collapse that the Fed has succeeded in this campaign to try to prevent the apocalypse from happening.
Yeah. So we talked earlier in the year about how people just needed to hold on to what they had in their retirement accounts.
Isn't it nice when the advice turns out to be right?
It really does. And, you know, I have to say, at one point this year, a lot of people like me would look at their 401k and 403b statements and they were down, you know, 12% on the year. Well, I just looked recently and I'm now only down 2%. Now, still, I'm down, which is a bummer. But I held, just like you said to do. And there is a real lesson in that, isn't there?
Well, let me leap right on that, because now that you're back, what, 2% you said?
I'm down 2%.
You're down 2%. Yeah. Okay. What did you learn from the 11% decline? Were you too risky? As the market settles down, as the market improves, that's when you want to make adjustments to your portfolio. When you get a decent price for making your adjustments, you're not going to be realizing all these losses. But you know what? Markets fluctuate. And here's a forecast. We're going to have another recession.
This is going to happen again.
In another couple of years.
Yeah.
We're going to get a real bear market, because think about it. This stock market is only down 11% from its October peak of 2007.
And an official bear market is 20%.
It's 20%. And it's a safe forecast over the next 5, 6, 7 years. I bet we'll have a bear market, a real bear market.
Do you think we actually could at this point? I mean, maybe we're just up a little bit and it's going to crash?
You know, I'm in the camp that thinks the recession is going to be short and shallow. Hmm. And what really convinced me of that is the loss of 20,000 jobs in the latest employment report. And it's terrible that anybody is losing their job. But that does suggest short, shallow recession. And I think that we are in a recession. But let's say real estate prices go down farther.
Mm-hmm.
So you could spin off a scenario of oil prices going up higher, real estate prices going lower, and people all of a sudden going, this is going to be a bad recession. I don't think that's a scenario, but the risk is there.
Okay. So do you think the Fed is done with cutting interest rates at this point?
I think the Fed is absolutely done with cutting interest rates. It's always better when the economy is growing. No matter, even if it's growing slowly,
sure.
And because you do get some job creation. But here's what I think we all need to be focusing on going forward. Let's say the Fed is done with cutting its benchmark interest rate. And let's say the recession is short and shallow. What's it going to be like looking ahead? My suspicion is that this economy is going to be dissatisfying. It's going to be ugly for a long period of time, even when we come out of recession.
All right. The Straight Story from our own Chris Farrell. And we'll check in with you again later in the show, Getting Personal.
Thanks.
We mentioned food prices in our discussion of inflation. Well, did you know that your pension might be raising your grocery bill? And here's a way to invest your seed money.
You have 3 tomatoes. That'll be $12, please.
There you go.
You are now a farmer.
It's part of a Marketplace series, Food Fight, all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund.
In Haiti, deadly riots over food prices.
Costco is now limiting purchases of rice and
stuff. Winter wheat in Kansas City's up 25 cents. Corn.
If you've been hit with sticker shock at the grocery store, chew on this. Food prices are expected to rise another 5% this year. Today, we continue our look at the global food crisis, a series called Food Fight. No doubt you've already heard some of the reasons behind the high prices. Countries like China and India starting to consume as much as we do. A drought in Australia leading to a worldwide run on rice. Well, here's another factor. Big pension funds want to profit from these soaring commodity prices. Marketplace's Jill Barshay reports on institutional investors who are earning more for their retirees while inadvertently contributing to higher food costs.
Pension funds and commodity markets are a bit like princes and porters. They inhabit the same world, but they don't have much to do with each other. Or that's the way it used to be. Recently, princely pension funds, who usually buy stocks and bonds, began poking their noses in the pits. The commodity pits, that is.
No, we don't personally do that, but our managers would go down to the pits and trade on occasion. They're actually buying wheat futures contracts, livestock contracts.
Alan Nord is chief investment officer of the Pennsylvania Public School Employees Retirement System. It's the 13th largest pension fund in the country. He started investing in commodities last year. Now he's got $1.2 billion in grains and livestock.
Well, we were looking for something that when stocks went down, another asset class would go up. And commodities, we thought, fit that bill pretty well. We had a very good year last year. Our commodities were up about 27% or so.
The Pennsylvania pension is just one of the dozens of endowments, foundations, and funds that have invested $180 billion in commodities. Similar funds like the California Public Employees Retirement System have helped to quadruple this number over the last 4 years. Kristen Powers is an associate professor at California State University, Long Beach. She says she'll qualify for a CalPERS pension in 30 years. But she worries all this pension money could drive up the price of things like flour and rice.
What would concern me is if people around the world who are not middle class actually would not be able to feed their children. If by investing in commodities, it results in a shortage of affordable food for people in developing countries, that would be a big concern for me.
While Powers worries that pension money could skew the commodities market, others fear commodities could skew pension fund returns. Keith Black is a commodities specialist at Enos Knupp, a consulting firm that advises pension funds. He says surprises like the weather can whipsaw markets and introduce sharp ups and downs into investment portfolios.
Commodities themselves can be extremely volatile. You have the ability to have significant price declines because this has been a volatile asset class, returning 30% a year over the last 2 or 3 years.
Black recently co-wrote a study advising pension funds against a stampede into commodities. The risks are even greater for individuals. Black says investors who buy commodities on the spot market have done worse than keeping their money in cash.
Just because pensions are increasing their allocations to commodity markets doesn't mean that it's appropriate for all retail investors to do that in their own retirement accounts.
Indeed, even those pension managers who've already jumped into commodities are getting cautious. They're worried prices could tumble from their current heights. Van Noord of the Pennsylvania Pension has temporarily stopped adding fresh cash to his commodity portfolio, even though his board approved another $850 million. In New York, I'm Jill Barchet for Marketplace Money.
So what can you do to save on food costs, short of, you know, buying a farm? Well, you might not have to buy a whole farm, but you could just grow a portion of your own food. Seeds are cheap, and with a little rain, sunshine, and TLC, you've got yourself dinner, right? Stacey Vanek-Smith tested her green thumb to see how it all adds up.
There's a patch of land behind my apartment, and I'm pretty sure my landlord won't mind if I plant a few things there. So I decide to try growing tomatoes, and this makes me part of a growing trend of urban gardeners. Robert Gottlieb directs the Urban and Environmental Policy Institute at Occidental College. He says rising food prices, combined with an interest in organic and local foods, have created the perfect climate for a grow-your-own boom.
You're not simply seeing a passing fad. You're seeing something that's really significant in relation to how people think about food itself and these economic factors as well.
Seed sales are up about a quarter over last year. Sales of gardening supplies are up too. But does it make economic sense to grow your own food? This I had to see for myself, so I went to the Los Angeles Garden Show. A company called Tomato Mania was selling more than 75 different kinds of tomatoes with names like Green Zebra and Black Prince. Already, this was vastly more complicated than the supermarket, where tomato selection is pretty much confined to small, medium, and large. Luckily, Tomato Mania's Debbie Wiles helped me pick.
I would go with a cherry. I would go with possibly a Roma, which is good for cooking in sauces. And then a nice meaty slicer, like a beefsteak or an ox heart.
Debbie tells me they should bear fruit in a couple of months.
That'll be $12, please.
There you go.
Thank you very much. You are now a farmer.
Oh, yeah, I am a farmer. I'm reducing my carbon footprint, healing the global food crisis, and all for $12. This is looking good, especially considering a pound of tomatoes at the supermarket costs $4. And, Debbie tells me, in the right hands, one tomato plant can easily produce 20 tomatoes a year. But first I have to actually grow them, so I stop by Sunset Nursery, where assistant manager Sally Melcher tells me she's seeing a lot of first-time gardeners this year.
Usually early spring is a fairly even mix between flowers and vegetables, and this year I think we're selling a lot more vegetables than flowers. We've seen a huge increase in our seed sales.
Melcher sets me up with everything I need to start planting. And that's when my economic model gets a little strained.
And three tomato cages, $6.99 each. Trowel is $6.99. And your total is $47.76.
Ouch. Suddenly the grocery store's tomatoes at $4 a pound seem pretty reasonable. But I'm just a novice. I decide to consult an experienced gardener. William Alexander is the author of The $64 Tomato. He and his wife have had their own vegetable garden in upstate New York for years. Alexander says there's nothing like growing your own food to give you an appreciation for what a good deal the grocery store is.
When I saw that the green beans that I had labored to pick over, and it takes forever to pick a pound of green beans, and that my local green market was selling them for $1 a pound, I couldn't believe it.
Among Alexander's unexpected expenses, hundreds of dollars for good topsoil, lots of gardening tools, and a 10,000-volt fence to keep deer out. Not necessary in my Los Angeles neighborhood, where the only native creatures are feral cats and hipsters. In the end, Alexander figured that his homegrown heirloom tomatoes had cost about $64 a piece.
I think I went through something close to the five stages of grief. I was angry at first, and then I was shocked, and then I started to deal with it.
Alexander says these days he breaks about even on his garden. Not so in my case. For what I spent on three tomato plants, I could have purchased about 12 pounds of tomatoes from the store. And I'm not even sure I like tomatoes that much. But Alexander assures me there are other rewards.
I'm picking my first lettuce probably next week. And you can't buy lettuce like that at any price.
Just wait until you try my $59 tomato sauce. In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
All right, it's time for Getting Personal, when we answer all kinds of confusing personal finance questions from you. And with me once again is our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hello again, Chris.
Hello again. And so what do you got for me?
Well, we've got Rhea, and she is with us from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, Rhea.
Hi there. How are you?
We're doing great. And you?
I'm good, thank you.
All right. What's your question for Chris today?
My question is, I'm about 10 years out of early retirement at 62. Recently, a financial advisor of mine talked to me about annuities for retirement purposes. And as much as I tried to understand them, I really don't completely get it. But what he recommended was to take half of my IRA and potentially invest it in an annuity for some stable income. And my question goes around that. Really, what is an annuity? Is it recommended with where we are in the market these days?
Okay, well, let's take your questions one at a time.
Okay.
First of all, what is an annuity?
An annuity, and the type of annuity that, Rhea, you're being sold, I assume, is what we call a variable annuity. To you and I, it appears like a mutual fund. You fund it with after-tax dollars. Your money compounds tax-free until you withdraw the money, in which case at that point you pay ordinary income taxes on it. What I'm not sure is what the financial advisor is suggesting, but it sounds like he's suggesting that you have your IRA or half of your IRA as part of this variable annuity. But I got a couple warning bells going off, and I'm going to go right to my bottom line here, which is if you don't really understand how a product works, you don't invest in it. One of the concerns that I have is you don't want to mix in the same vehicle an IRA and a variable annuity. And the reason why you don't is that an IRA is a tax-sheltered investment. A variable annuity is a tax-sheltered investment. If you mix the two together, you're wasting one of the most valuable aspects of an IRA, which is that it is a tax-sheltered investment.
Okay. The problem with the IRAs is that the market has been so volatile recently that it is not protected as well as the annuities are. Is that correct?
Yeah, we certainly are finding that, and we talked about this earlier in the show, Chris, where, you know, it has been a wild roller coaster on the stock market, but, you know, your mantra is always you got to stick in there and hold it and not fold it.
But my question is, well, my long term might be when it's going down again.
So my main reaction to that is you need to have a more conservative portfolio. The variable annuity is a good product for rich people.
What is your definition of rich these days?
Excellent question.
My definition of rich is somebody who owns their own home, has maxed out on their 401k, their 403b, has maxed out on their IRA or their Roth IRA. And once you've gone through all those basics, they still have discretionary income to invest.
Okay. That would not be me.
Okay. That would not be a lot of people. All right. Does that help you out, Rhea?
Yeah, it does. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Well, if you have some questions you need answered, do let us help. Visit our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on the Getting Personal link or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. All right, let's reach into the email bag. And Michael writes in from Rancho Cucamonga, California, not far from where we're sitting. And he recently received an email from E-Trade. This is the online brokerage. Seems he has an account with them, and they must love him because it sounds like they're giving him five times the protection should anything catastrophic happen to E-Trade, which there were many rumors a few months ago that something catastrophic was going to happen.
I think there may be a relationship there.
I think so. So anyway, this note from E-Trade said that the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, offers insurance up to $100,000 for the cash in his account. But E-Trade is a member of SIPC.
SIPC.
And this protects people who hold stock up to $500,000. What is this SIPC?
That's the Securities Investor Protection Corporation. Okay, when you're a customer of a brokerage house, you have several layers of protection. First, your assets. They're segregated from the firm's assets. So if the firm gets in trouble, you still have your stocks and your bonds in a segregated account. That's your first line of defense. Then comes in SIPC, and that protection is up to $500,000 per customer.
So this is totally on the level, and it's a good thing for Michael.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, this is still a little confusing, Chris. Is there anywhere folks can go to get some more details about this?
Ah, the web. The web. So there's the SIPC.org. At this point in time, I think it's a really good idea that people understand how SIPC works.
All right. And we'll have a link to that on our website. It's marketplace.org. And there you can also find the link to Getting Personal, which is where you can send us all of your personal finance questions or give us a call. Our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And stay tuned for more Getting Personal later in the show. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Ah, life on a farm. Getting up early to milk the cows, smelling fresh-cut grass, and, of course, the clamor of car horns, shoppers, and public buses. At least, that's what it's like when your farm is located in the city. On this week's A Day in the Work Life, we visit with a new kind of farmer, the urban kind that Stacy mentioned earlier in the show. He started an agribusiness in his own backyard.
What we have here is we have ground cover strawberries, so we can, you know, get those luscious strawberries. We have leftover kale from the winter, and we're transitioning here from broccoli that we had, and we're going to replace it with peppers.
My name is Jules Derves. I'm 59 years old, and my primary job is that of a gardener. I guess why I call myself a gardener versus calling myself a farmer is that I'm trying to separate myself from people that have the notion that we have fields and that we have equipment and that I'm out there, you know, working the acreage that doesn't exist on this in the city. We have a fifth of an acre lot. So I'm trying to make a distinction that we are basically micro farmers or maximum extreme gardener because we have maxed out this place with all the fruits and vegetables we grow. We sell first to the restaurants and caterers. It's like they have a sort of a standing order every week. And then whatever is left over, we offer to the general public. We have so much orders that we don't even need to go to a farmer's market. We have several restaurants that will take anything we have. Our problem is not having enough, not having the fields. I'm sure that they would want more if we could give it. What I like about this job is the sense of fulfillment that it gives me. And I feel empowered that I'm able to grow my own food, and I feel independent. I'm not tied to somebody else providing me with what I needed for life. Oh, yes, well, there's one thing I definitely dislike is the insecurity that this job brings. I have to learn that I'm not in charge here. Every time I feel like I'm in charge, something happens that let me know that, hey, you know, you're just a student here. You're not the big boss. It's nature that makes the call. Whatever happens, you have to live with. This last year, we were doing great guns on our harvest. We were very proud of going up and up and up and getting, you know, bigger harvest. And last year was the worst year ever. We lost 90% of our tomato crop. That was kind of scary because that was our cash crop. And we only had 10% of the normal. That was insecure. And we're waiting on this year. And if it doesn't happen this year, then I'm really going to be insecure. But I'll have to find something to do about it. Yeah. At the beginning, it's like any kind of new venture. You're going to lose money, I think they say, for at least the first 3 years. We're getting a little bit of profit now. I would say we could make under $20,000 here. That's going to be a funny number. They're going to think that's low, but we provide food for ourselves. We don't have many expenses. We don't have a food bill. We provide our own energy with solar panels. Our utility bill is practically nothing. So the 20, if we had that all every year, that could go a long way because we don't spend much. I want to do this till the end of my days. I want to be actively planting and growing things till the last. We think urban farms are great because they're small, and they're necessary because there's a lot of land here in the city that's unused. And boy, if you look around how bleak some of the cities are, you can use a farm here and there.
A Day in the Work Life was reported by April Lunston. All right, imagine your house is gone, burned, flooded. You're standing in the ruins with your insurance agent, and pen in hand, she asks, so what was in the house?
It's your shopping list when you go and rebuild your home.
How to take stock of everything so you don't forget, because trust me, you will. It's coming up next on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Veglund. 11 tornadoes ripped through Arkansas a week ago. Wildfires have already broken out here in Southern California, and hurricane season is only a few weeks away. If, God forbid, your house goes up in smoke or underwater in a flood, will you have proof for your insurance company of everything you owned? It's called a home inventory, and everyone should have one. I invited Candace Miller to my home to learn what to do. She's with the Insurance Information Network of California. Before we even went into the house, she quizzed me about the contents of my living room. So I listed them, and we headed for the front door.
Actually, as we're walking in, I'm remembering there's also a baby grand piano in there. All right.
So here you are. You had a test. You forgot that you had a baby grand piano in your living room. Imagine that you're trying to put together an insurance claim after you've lost your home or lost part of your home.
Yeah.
The stress, first of all, of trying to get a new roof over your head, combined with trying to remember all of that. The home inventory isn't just about making sure you have the right amount of insurance, but it's also, it's your shopping list when you go and rebuild your home.
I'm already seeing that I missed a whole bunch of stuff.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what you missed.
And I live in here every day. I completely missed this corner table and the lamp that's on top of it. All of our fireplace equipment,
I missed the mirror on the wall.
Also think about what sort of home you're in. You're in one of these sort of classic Pasadena homes with the lovely, I mean, I'm looking at the ceiling merging into the wall, and you also have wooden floors mm-hmm. in here. So this is a home that's got very particular details to it. And that's something, you know, you probably have talked about with your insurance agent. If you haven't, you might want to have these details replaced. You want to make sure that's built into your policy.
Okay, so what do I do then? Do I just start writing down every single thing that's in the room from ceiling to floor?
What I frankly recommend is taking a little video camera like this. Go around the house and actually sort of narrate what you've got. If you know the value of it, include that. Create your own little home movie that's a documentary of your home.
So when we look at putting a value on some of these things, like the television, the couch, the glass table that was a hand-me-down from my parents, do I actually need to tell the insurance company, you know, the couch we bought for X, the TV we bought for X? Because I don't even know that I still have those receipts.
Exactly. I get asked all the time, do I have to keep every receipt for everything I've ever bought? The answer is no. What you can do, again, as you're going through, if you create the video, just say what you know about it.
All right, let's go into the kitchen because I have some questions about how detailed you need to get in a place that has all kinds of really small stuff.
Okay.
All right, so here we are in the kitchen with the dog barking outside. And, you know, there are dishes, there are glasses, there are pots and pans and small appliances and large appliances. How detailed do I need to get?
Well, this is where the video certainly comes in handy. That's okay. What I recommend. The video camera will let you zero in on, let's say, all those knives over there. That's a lot of money just hanging there on your wall.
Right.
And so if you've got a video camera, you can open all your cabinets, all your cupboards, narrate as best you can. This is the brand. This is, if you know that detail, it's going to help you get that much more compensation if you lose it.
All right, well, let's pretend that we've gone through the whole kitchen. The kitchen is done, thank goodness. Let's go out in the backyard.
Okay.
I have some questions back there. Come on. So here we are in my backyard, and my question back here is, you know, obviously the patio furniture, we would be able to get an estimate on that. But, you know, I estimated between 70 and 80 rose bushes, front and backyard. Now that is a lot of money. Is that something that I would ever be reimbursed for? Is that part of a homeowner's policy?
Somewhat. However, there are typically limits on landscape damage. But you want to talk about that with your agent. Is there some sort of endorsement? Because typically you're going to have some fairly low limits on landscaping. It's about rebuilding your house.
Right, right. Okay. I wonder if we should take a look at the closet.
If you're ready, I am.
Just don't pay attention to that. It's very messy. So what? Would I take a picture of this?
In a word, yes. You want to know how many shoes you own. Now, are you going to hold up every shoe and say, this is a Nike, this is a Payless? You don't necessarily have to do it, but you want to have this document because, if you lost it, how much value do you have inside that closet?
But how do you place a value on any of that in terms of what you're getting through your insurance company?
Typically, your closet shouldn't be the thing that breaks the bank. There are times, unfortunately, if there's a catastrophe where you may have to start documenting this stuff, literally, the point is to get you up to that limit that you have to say, yes, I met it. So if you've got this sort of documentation, this is one of those pieces that's really almost more for after the fact.
Okay, so it's not necessarily something that affects your policy beforehand. It's more to help you as you tell the insurance company, this is what I lost.
The closet is about the recovery side of it. Now, what we did in the living room, that's about making sure you're properly insured.
So once you've got the video and the photos and you've written everything down, what do you do with that information?
Well, a couple things. I really recommend using software like we discussed because it helps you get organized. It goes room by room and creates that list. What's most important, though, is when you're done with it, get it out of the house. You can put it in cyberspace and lock it down on your personal website. You can put it in a safe deposit box in a bank. You can send it off to your parents, someone you trust, but get it out of the house.
And is it something that you actually send to the insurance company or is that something that you do afterwards?
You can do a bit of it up front. You want to talk to your agent and say, okay, let's talk about my piano, for example. Do I need more coverage to make sure that that can be replaced if it's lost? But on the back end, if there's a loss, that's where the home inventory really helps you recover. It gives you a shopping list for basic things, but also helps make sure that you get all the money that's coming to you.
Well, Candace Miller, Executive Director of the Insurance Information Network of California, thank you so much for going through my house today.
You're welcome.
Would you like to get out of the closet now?
You bet.
We have a link to a free downloadable home inventory checklist on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrive and Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 company helping members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thriveand.com/retirement. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. And by Gather.com, where people can stay in touch with who they know and what they love. You can discover unsigned musicians, discuss books, share pictures, and keep up with the world. People are talking. Gather.com.
We're back with Getting Personal, and Brian from Ann Arbor, Michigan, emailed our first question, Chris. He has two Coverdale IRAs for his two children.
Used to be called the Education IRA.
Exactly. And he contributes to these when he can, but he's heard that the program is set to expire in the year 2010.
Well, here's what's going to happen, Brian. In its wisdom, when Congress rewrote the rules with the Pension Protection Act of 2006, made a number of changes in the 529 plan permanent. So, for example, when you withdraw your money from a 529 plan and you go to pay for qualified educational expenses, it's free of taxes.
Right.
But with the Coverdale, they left it alone. So some very good features of the Coverdale will expire in 2010. He's absolutely right. Now, the Coverdale doesn't disappear, but what will happen is right now he can put, or anybody can put, $2,000 into a Coverdale. That will shrink to $500. It will continue to exist, but it will become a less attractive program. So what you can do, you can leave the money there, do a tax-free rollover of the money into a 529 plan, and start contributing to the 529 plan.
Okay. Well, as we've just noted, we're all about education here on Marketplace Money. So do give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or head on over to our website. It's marketplace.org and click on the Getting Personal link there. All right, let's go to the phones again. And Tom is calling from Livingston, Montana. Hi, Tom.
Hi, guys.
What do you do there in Montana?
I'm retired. A lot of skiing and a lot of fishing and
enjoying this
beautiful place.
Sounds wonderful. Who did you work for?
I worked for United Parcel Service for 30 years.
Okay, all right. And what's your question for Chris today?
I have a question. We have a situation in the United States right now. It's called an auction rate preferred security.
Uh-oh, yep. We're very familiar with these.
Okay. I really don't have a question as much as I would just like people to know about this.
All right. Well, let's go ahead. Chris, can you define an auction rate security for us? This has been in the news a lot recently because of the credit crunch.
Yes, and it is a real black mark on Wall Street. What it is a $330 billion market. These were marketed as, you know, they're almost as liquid as a money market mutual fund, but you get a higher interest rate.
But what we found is that they are not quite as liquid as they were promised.
There are no buyers. At this particular point in time, the market is ground to a halt. All the firms are struggling to figure out what to do about this. Usually what they're doing right now, because people might have thought, well, I'm going to pay my tax bill with this money. Mm-hmm. So we'll lend you some money. No. We'll lend you a little bit. Oh, by the way, and we'll charge you a cheap rate of interest, 3%.
So, Tom, I'm guessing that you owned some of these.
You're correct. My biggest question is why there was no notification.
So your broker never let you know?
My broker did not let me know, did not let my other friends that are involved know either.
Chris, is this something that brokers should have been telling their clients?
Oh, absolutely should have been telling their clients. It's caught a lot of people. At this point in time, Tom, I think it has grabbed everybody's attention because the problem hasn't gone away.
So is there any way that he's going to be able to get his money out?
Yes, I do believe that he will get his money out. To a large extent, I see that the credit crunch is starting to abate. It's not over with, nowhere, but it was starting to abate. There are a lot of solutions that are being tried. A lot of firms are really embarrassed about this. But one of the troubling aspects of it is there are a number of money market mutual funds that own subprime securities. And there was a real risk that the dollar that you put into that money market mutual fund would no longer be worth a dollar. And a number of firms stepped in, and they made sure that that didn't happen. It is unclear with this market. I think everybody will eventually get out at what we call at par. They'll get their money back. But the firms actually haven't been stepping up, and it's disturbing.
So, Tom, did you have a need for this money right away?
Oh, absolutely. I need to come up with a big chunk of it in less than a month's time from now. And I'm basically strapped. I don't know what to do.
Yeah, and what the firms are doing, as I understand it, is they're offering customers low interest rate loans under the circumstances.
Is that something that you would think about doing, Tom?
Well, I don't really want to, but I don't think I have a choice at this time.
So, Chris, let me ask you, is there a larger lesson here for investors in general? I mean, nobody saw this coming, and auction rate securities were considered and were marketed as this great financial vehicle. And this has happened before, certainly. Auction rate securities are not the first time. How do you know where your money is safe?
The only lesson that I take from it, and it's one that I know from a lot of our listeners, sometimes it's annoying. If you're getting a higher interest rate relative to a very safe security, such as a treasury bill, you are taking higher risk. We don't know where that risk lies. Keep it conservative in terms of the amount of money that you're exposed. Probably nothing ever happens. But every once in a while, something like a credit crunch comes through and the risks all of a sudden become apparent.
All right. So, Tom, unfortunately, it doesn't sound like we have a whole lot of advice for you except to hang on and maybe go ahead and see if you can get one of those loans against it.
Right. I just wanted to get it out in the open, and because it hasn't been up here at all.
Yep.
And so I appreciate your guys following up and letting me at least get out there and let people know what's happening.
Well, we appreciate the call. Thanks so much.
Well, thanks, you guys. Bye-bye.
Take care. Well, Chris, unfortunately, on that note, those are all the questions we can take for this week's show. But Chris is now answering your personal finance questions online every weekday. Just visit our website. It's marketplace.org and click on the Getting Personal link. You can also call us at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, and we spell that M-O-N-Y. Chris, thanks as always for the great advice.
Thanks a lot, Tess.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. There's some relief this week for college students who are worried about the effect of the credit crunch on their loan prospects. The president signed legislation aimed at stabilizing the $85 billion market. And for the details, we turn once again to Kim Clark of U.S. News and World Report. And Kim, tell us briefly, what does this new law do for students who need help paying for college?
Yeah, it's doing two things that relate to the credit crunch. One is it's giving parents who are having trouble with a mortgage, let's say their mortgage reset higher and now they're having trouble making those payments. Those parents used to not be able to get a parent loan. Now they will be able to get a parent loan. The other thing they're doing is the federal government is going to act as the lender of last resort. So if you are awarded, let's say, a Stafford loan, which is the standard student loan, and you go to your normal bank and say, okay, I got a Stafford loan, can I have it, please? And they say, oh, no, we've decided we're not doing that anymore. Now you go to your school, and the school is the one that's supposed to find out who you're supposed to go to and how you can get your Stafford loan.
All right, so all of this is for federally backed loans. What about the private student loan industry? Where does this leave that?
Well, also this week there was a lot of news on that front because one of the biggest players in the private student loan market is called First Marblehead. They laid off more than half their staff, and they just are losing tons of money because, in part, this new legislation is going to eat into their market by allowing people to borrow more and giving people who have kind of dodgy credit a chance to borrow under the federal program. Those people are not going to be borrowing private loans anymore, which is sort of better because the federal loans are a better deal. They're cheaper and they offer more options like extended payback and, you know, deferrals and so on.
All right. I know you've written a lot about the student loan industry, and I wonder if you might have perhaps an unusual method for students who are looking for any way to save a buck as they head to college.
Well, I think one of the best ways to save money on college is to look at the things that people don't even think about. There's this growing movement, the co-op movement is coming back from the 60s. Students can enter these co-op dorms and do maybe 5 hours of chores a week and save thousands of dollars. One of the best examples is at UCLA, right there in Los Angeles near UTES. If you sign up for one of these co-op dorms, you save more than $6,000 for 5 hours of cleaning up and maybe scrubbing the bathroom. But big deal. I figured it out. You're earning basically $39 an hour for those chores. So it's a great way to save money.
Do we really think that Gen Y is ready to do chores?
I think they are. These are definitely coming back, because when you think about, you could borrow that money, or you could not go to UCLA, or you could go to UCLA. And, okay, so you have to do 5 hours of chores a week. I think that's a no-brainer. I think you know what the right decision is.
Kim Clark is a senior writer with U.S. News and World Report. Thanks, Kim.
You bet.
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, getting the most out of your dough, the yeasty kind.
I go to the 99-cent store and I buy a full loaf of bread for $1.50. It's cheaper bread, cheaper quality, but it's more to feed my kids.
Marketplace Money is produced by Nancy Fargali with Stephen Hoffman, James Richter, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
American Public Media.